Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Where the Forest Meets the River by Shannon Bowring, narrated by Patricia Shade. May 1995. The road was new to me, as roads always are, going back. Sarah Orne Jewett, The Country of the Pointed Firs and Other Stories. Returning. The way home gets longer each time he returns, the miles dragging out in an unbroken chain of forest, field, sky, forest, field, sky. Greg can't shake the feeling he's fallen into an episode of the Twilight Zone, doomed to drive the same blank stretch of Route 11 for eternity. He can practically hear Rod Serling's voice as he eases his mother's old Chevy around another blind corner. And here, on this road to nowhere, we have a young man devoted to nothing but distance. Distance between himself and the northern Maine town he left behind. Greg rolls down the window to let the warm spring breeze punch him in the face. Good. He cranks the volume on the tape deck to hear Linda Perry wailing about her disappointment in the world. Better. In the trunk and back seat, stuffed in boxes, is his life as a college freshman. Term papers, textbooks, ticket stubs from the Orono Movie House, Pulp Fiction, Dolores Claiborne. There's the geometric print comforter his mother bought him. Isn't it cool, sweetie? And piles of laundry. Razors, half-empty shampoo bottles, flip-flops for the communal showers. Somehow he ended up with his roommate's Black Bear sweatshirt, the one David wore so often first semester Greg mocked him for being a walking UMaine billboard. A green sign appears on the shoulder of the road to tell Greg he's got 42 miles to go. Imagining what waits for him ahead in Dalton, he wishes it were 42,000. Lame enough his sister is marrying the potato king in a couple weeks, but why did she have to force Greg into being their best man? He and Sarah have barely talked since he left for college last fall. Hell, they barely talked before that, when he was still at home and she was living in a one-bedroom apartment over the Stornmore. Why doesn't Ian have his brother do it? Greg asked when she cornered him beside their parents' fake Christmas tree the last time he was up north. Charlie's unreliable, and you'll look better in a suit. Seriously? No, not seriously. But at least you'll fit into one now. Greggy, you skinny little stud. Then she poked at his flat stomach, laughing as he tried to squirm away. All through high school, he had been the fat kid. And then, the summer before college, Greg had a late-to-the-party growth spurt. Shot up 2 inches and could practically feel his metabolism running on high, vibrating through his veins. Suddenly, in possession of more energy than he ever dreamed possible, he stopped binging junk food and took up running instead, hitting the deserted streets of Dalton on early summer mornings before the sun was all the way awake. By the time he left for college, he'd lost 36 pounds. "It's just such a miracle," his mother said, which he guessed was meant to be a compliment, but felt more like a slap to the face. As if only divine intervention could have saved him from a lifetime of stretchy pants and hardened arteries. When he looks in the mirror these days, Greg can now admit he isn't terrible looking. The weight is gone, the acne is cleared up, and his thick brown hair behaves without any of that nasty product David uses. At school, girls flirted with him, asked him to parties and late-night study sessions, even though he almost always declined. But the truth is, he is just as self-conscious now as he was when he was fat. The few times he accepted invitations to frat houses or dorm rooms, he couldn't do much more than choke down stale beer, laugh nervously, and spout off unasked-for facts about how many inches bamboo can grow in a day, 35, and how many pencils could be created from the wood of an average-sized tree, about 170,000. In those moments of attempted socialization, Greg always felt like he was flubbing the lines of a character he didn't understand in a play he'd never pay to see, let alone one he would expect other people to suffer through. The pavement and the forest unspool before him, unchanging, while the Cranberries play on the mixtape. Rod Serling really would love this. And here we see our queer 19-year-old as he drives toward the town he left behind, driving closer, but getting, somehow, further and further away. He's got to get off this damn road. His first stop in Dalton is Trudy Haskell's house. He pulls into the driveway, tooting his horn several times just to get her agitated. Not that that's difficult. Looking up from where she's watering her allium patch, Trudy scowls. "Damn it, Gregory," she shouts. "You scared away my birds." He parks the car and strides across the lawn, inhaling the heady scent of lilac and viburnum, taking in the sight of new growth and soon-to-blossom flowers. "Garden looks good," he says as he hands Trudy a small, unwrapped box. "What the hell is this? You shouldn't be spending money on an old lady." "I didn't. You won't be officially old for a few more years." "For Christ's sake." She sets down her watering can and lifts the lid on the box, her eyes shifting from cold iron to partially molten silver. "A four-leaf clover," she says. "I'll be damned. You know, all these years in the garden, and I only ever found one. Then I got distracted and couldn't find the son of a bitch again." "Try not to lose this one." Greg lifts the delicate pane of pressed glass from the box and holds it up so the sun hits the clover from behind, illuminating all the tiny veins. "I spent hours lying on the quad with a magnifying glass, looking for this guy." "Did you really?" "God, no. Found it by accident, outside my dorm." "Little shit." She leads him on a tour around the garden, pointing out the remaining yellow tulips, the buds on the peonies. "Getting pretty overrun here," says Greg, crouching down to rip a handful of weeds from the ground. "You'll have your work cut out for you this season. Hope you're up for it." Greg's stomach clenches. Throughout high school, most of his free hours in the growing seasons were spent here in this garden with Trudy, following her direction on how to divide bulbs, mix soil, tell the difference between foxglove and delphinium. Just one more thing that made him a weirdo, a close friendship with a 40-something-year-old librarian. "I'll try to find time to help you," he says, "but Dad's still hell-bent on getting me into the store this summer." Trudy keeps her eyes on the ants drinking sap from a peony bud. "You know, I'd rather..." "You thirsty?" she asks. "I'm goddamn parched." They settle on the creaky porch swing with two glasses of iced tea and watch the birds. Sparrows in the stone bath, goldfinches on the suet, robins on the lawn, hoping for worms. Trudy takes a sip of tea, ice clinking against the glass. "How'd you do on finals?" "Mostly B's. Aced my intro to plant science exam, though."
"Did you? Imagine that."
Across the street at the grade school, there's a burst of happy shouts as kids stream outside for recess, running toward the same wooden castle Greg once collected splinters from when he was that little.
"You picked a major yet?"
"Still undeclared."
"Why don't you just go for horticulture?"
Running his thumb over the beads of condensation on his glass, Greg considers how to respond. Hard to give an answer, though, when you've barely given yourself permission to ask the question.
"Mom and Dad don't think it's a practical degree," he finally says.
His wish to go downstate for college was debated for months before his parents relented, saying they would help pay for it only if Greg promised to come back up north to work in the hardware store each summer. Along with this is the expectation that after he graduates from Orono, he will return to work with his father full-time, eventually becoming the next Fortin man to supply Dalton with its hardware needs. All his life, Greg has carried an unchanging image in his mind. His father,
dressed in faded Wranglers and a corduroy shirt, bent over the counter at the store, surrounded by boxes of nails and thumbtacks. The gold frames of his glasses shine under the fluorescent lights, and his brown eyes squint at the stack of receipts laid out in front of him. Always keeping track of the numbers, always thinking of the bottom line. Not that he's an old Scrooge or anything. His father is friendly and generous, the guy everyone in town goes to for advice on nail guns and dysfunctional garbage disposals. Thanks to him, people can fix their toilets, install linoleum, paint their nurseries, build porches, light their moldy cellars. Every home in Dalton has a piece of Jim Fortin inside it, or so Greg's mother likes to say. It's not a terrible legacy or a terrible life. It's just not the life Greg wants.
What did your father do for a living?
He asks Trudy. He and my mother were dairy farmers.
Did they want you to do the same thing?
Oh, no. I was always dropping the milk pails and spooking the cows. They watch as a robin tries to pull a worm up from the ground, hopping in mad little circles as the worm refuses to loosen its grip on the earth. Finally, with one big yank, the worm is ripped in half, its head disappearing into the robin's beak. But Gregory... Trudy turns to look at him with steely, unblinking eyes. You and I both know you're not the hammer-selling type. He has never had to tell her he's attracted to both girls and guys, just as she has never had to explain to him that Bev Thoreau is a hell of a lot more to her than her longtime best friend. They understand these things, these secrets, with something beyond language, the same way Greg often knows what song is about to come on the radio or who is calling before he picks up the phone. Any hot dates down there at school? Asks Trudy in her best, almost gentle voice. He stares out at the maples edging the yard, the sun playing hide-and-seek behind the new green leaves moving in the breeze. Remembers the swirly sensation in his stomach as he tried to flirt with the freckle-faced girl from English comp. The corpse flower, he told her, smells so bad some people pass out from it. Or the party last month in the hilltop dorms when he was pressed into a corner with that guy with the coal black hair who kept discreetly touching Greg's arm, giving him the look when no one else was paying attention. And all he could do was yammer on about the differences between peaches and nectarines. Here's the thing, Greg says to Trudy, I'm going to die a virgin. She lets out a bark of laughter, then points toward a scraggly peony bush whose buds are tighter and paler than the rest. See that bastard? Every year, I'm sure it's going to die off. Then, every year, weeks after all the others, it blossoms like a son of a bitch.
So you're saying I'm a late bloomer?
I'm saying better a little too late than a lot too early. He and Trudy sit on the porch long after the school bell rings and all the kids across the street have run back inside, destined for paste-scented classrooms. All around them, thick in the afternoon air, is Greg's favorite smell in the world. Newly woken flowers, breathing summer to life. His mother's constant touch, hugs and shoulder rubs and hair tousles. His father whistling as he sets the table. His little sister, dressed like the ghost of Kurt Cobain. Mustard yellow kitchen walls, overcooked lasagna, smell of dish soap. Potpourri in the bathroom. TV turned up too loud on a black and white Western. Bad southern drawls and shootouts, cowboys versus Indians. Crooked lampshade on a nightstand, broken umbrella in the back of a closet. The welcome sensation of comfort and familiarity nestled right up alongside the buzzing, hungry desire to run out the front door, get back in the car, and start speeding south. In other words, home. Greg wakes early the next morning. In the pink-orange light of a sun reluctantly rising, he rubs the sleep from his eyes and rolls out of bed. From one of his piles of laundry, he pulls a pair of gym shorts, socks, a Radiohead t-shirt. As soon as he slips on his running shoes, he feels something inside him settle, like a panicked bird finally resting on a branch. When he steps out into the cool dawn air, he takes what feels like his first full breath since he drove away from campus yesterday morning. The town is still, but not at all silent. As Greg jogs down High Street, he hears the boom of lumber dropped from forklifts out at the mill, the subtle hum of teethed machinery that chew trees up and spit them out as plywood. Jake breaks on Route 11. Robins and chickadees calling. On Main Street, the only business open is the Store and More. Lights shining yellow. Through the window near the loading dock, he sees the tall form of Bev Thoreau behind the deli counter, slicing bread. A few cars and trucks trundle past him, drivers lifting their hands in motionless greeting. As he heads up Prescott Road, sweat pricks under his arms, and his breath finds its rhythm. The muscles in his calves tighten as his heart chugs along, strong and quick. He half hopes to catch Angela Muse's mother smoking a cigarette on the front porch of the little house across from the Pinewood Tavern, but there are no signs of life other than a scruffy calico eyeing him from the driveway. Past the high school, down Winter, Greg smiles to see Trudy's kitchen light on, and back onto Main, pointed north. By the time he reaches the hardware store, he's drenched in sweat, all his muscles aching in that delirious rush he has come to crave just as much as he once longed for candy bars and mint chip ice cream. His father's red pickup is parked behind the store, and the office light is on in the back. Greg feels a tug toward that light, that room, where he knows his father is writing out orders at his metal desk. Every Saturday of Greg's life, it was that desk and those order forms and the pencils with greasy erasers that always left smudge marks on his father's palms. If he were to enter through the back door right now, his father would look up from the desk and grin.
"Couldn't resist the siren call, could you, son?"
He would offer Greg a clean rag to wipe the sweat from his face and invite him to sit down beside him to review the orders for wood screws and staple guns and copper pipe, eager to pass along the knowledge he spent a lifetime gathering. Greg takes in a deep breath of green air and gold sun and keeps running, past the store, the fire station, down around the Catholic Church, up Rich Fucker Road, the town and valley and forest and river spread out behind him. Each time his feet hit the pavement, his calves screech and sing. Bone-deep ache. Delicious freedom. Gravity pulling him down to the earth as the summer wind pushes him forward. Adaptations. Trudy is the first person in the post office when it opens on Saturday morning. Marching past the wall of most wanted posters, why can't criminals brush their teeth once in a while? She heads straight for the front counter. Rings the little brass bell once, then twice. She can hear Bev's voice in her mind telling her to be patient for once in her life. But she has better things to do than stand around here all day. She's about to ring the bell a third time when Gloria Arsenault trudges out from the employees-only door and steps behind the counter. Her hair, which hasn't moved since the mid-80s, smells of cigarette smoke. There's a shine of sugar on her lips, as though she were out back slamming down donuts before deciding to get to work. "Help you?" she asks in a bored voice. "I ordered a dress from the Penny's catalog a month ago," says Trudy, "and it still isn't here, even though it was only supposed to take 2 weeks."
"Bummer."
"I've called the shipping department twice, and twice they've told me the dress was sent here a week ago, so why haven't I received it?"
"If we had it, we'd have put it in your box,"
So this is what Trudy's tax dollars pay for. Incompetence. Ambivalence. Can you please just check in the back? She knows how bitchy she sounds, but doesn't care. She knows she could drive 20 minutes to the mall and buy a different dress, but she refuses. This dress from the catalog is the only one she will wear to Greg's sister's wedding. It's the perfect shade of green. When Gloria sighs, a yeasty smell comes pouring out of her mouth. I'm telling you it ain't back there, but I'll check if it'll make you happy. She disappears behind the door, leaving Trudy to flip through a book of stamps that spell out the word love in red letters above cherubs' bored faces. If there really are fat baby angels flying around up there, they must think it tragic. Their image is being used to mail water bills and birthday cards to distant cousins. The door of the building opens, and Trudy turns to see Annette Frazier stepping into the lobby. Talk about a tragedy. The woman is wearing sweatpants and a stained shirt. Her badly dyed hair falls across her face in greasy strands. Seeing Trudy, she pauses in a patch of sunlight pooling on the floor, then inches forward, like a cat ready to bolt at any moment. The closer she gets, the stronger the smell of unwashed skin and sour wine. So this is what losing a child can do, turn an overly chatty, image-obsessed woman into something barely human, something that can only be pitied. Hello, Annette, says Trudy, trying to keep her voice soft. That's how Bev would speak if she were here right now. Softly. Kindly. Nice day out there, isn't it? Bit too sunny. Bit too bright. Going to be a hot summer, if you can believe Channel 8. Yes, very hot. Holding up a small brass key, Annette jerks her head in the direction of the P.O. boxes and, without another word to Trudy, wanders off toward them. The employee's only door slams open, and Gloria huffs out with a roughed-up-looking package in her hand. She throws it onto the counter. Blame Dan, she says. Dan's the one who sorts everything back there. A minute later, on her way out of the building, Trudy gets stuck, holding the door open for Annette, whose arms are filled with two heavy-looking boxes. You want help with those? No, no. They step into the grass-scented morning, and Trudy watches as Annette maneuvers the boxes into the back of her car. Then she walks around to the driver's side and stands there, blinking up at the sun with mole-like eyes. For Christ's sake! This woman. Trudy wants to shake her, tell her to get a hold of herself. But she should show a little mercy. Keep trying to practice the damn kindness that comes so naturally to Bev. That Gloria's a real piece of work, don't you think? Annette doesn't answer. She doesn't say a word. Trudy spends the next several hours in the garden. Hands in the dirt, surrounded by the scent of peonies and roses, she lets her mind wander. First, to the new novel she's close to finishing, Snow Falling on Cedars, which she's pretty sure she'll assign for the June book group at the library. From there, she thinks of lonely men in lonely places, which leads her to Gregory Fortin, who should be here beside her tearing weeds from the earth. He comes from decent people, but Trudy has little faith his family will ever see that boy for who he truly is. Putting him to work in a hardware store of all places, and with the thought of long hours spent under buzzing bright lights, Trudy's thoughts turn to Bev, who once took so much pride in her job as director at the retirement village, and who now spends 40 hours a week tossing pizza dough and assembling Italian subs. Though it's only been a day since she saw Bev, Trudy already misses her. Nearly 20 years since they met and bonded over books and town-wide gossip, and still neither is a whole person unless the other is right there beside her. The love they share is so much deeper and more complex than a friendship or an affair or even a marriage. Maybe especially a marriage. Trudy tosses the weeds onto the brush pile at the edge of the lawn, then rinses her hands off under the hose, pausing to take a sip of the water, which tastes of dirt and warm rubber. The sun has wandered away from the center of the sky, but it will be hours before it reaches the horizon. Longer still before all its light disappears. Inside the house, she feeds Mycroft. He meows in approval when he realizes she's thrown some sliced turkey in with his cat food. Then she steps into the living room, where she finds Richard asleep in his recliner in front of an infomercial for hair tonic guaranteed to restore natural growth in as little as 6 weeks. His face is tilted back, mouth half open. One of his slippers has fallen off, revealing a black sock with a hole in the heel. Irritation tingles in Trudy's veins. Not that a man doesn't deserve a Saturday nap once in a while, but with Richard, it's more than a simple need to close his eyes for a few minutes. He only naps when he's in one of his funks. He's had these bouts of depression for the past 5 years, ever since Bridget Thoreau died. He's a good man, but he has one hell of a god complex, no doubt part of being a doctor. He still blames himself for Bridget's suicide, as though he could have done anything to save that girl. Richard lets out a low, pained moan in his sleep, as if trapped inside a nightmare. And another familiar feeling, this time of guilt, rushes through Trudy's bloodstream, pooling in the pit of her stomach. Never, not even in the early days of their courtship or marriage, did she ache for Richard when he wasn't with her. She thought of him fondly, was always glad to see him after a brief separation, but she didn't plan her outfits for him or count the hours and minutes until they were together again. A better wife, or at least a different one, might open the curtains her husband has pulled shut, let the sun pour in, and sit beside him. Turn the TV off, wake him with a kiss, convince him to start talking, unburden himself. Trudy leaves Richard asleep and alone in the darkened living room. Goes upstairs to find the perfect dress. Only 1 hour, 42 minutes, until she and Bev are together again. On the surface, nothing has really changed in Dalton since Bridget killed herself. Men still work 12-hour shifts at the Fraser Lumber Mill. Women still bust their asses working any job they can find, tending cash register, making Christmas wreaths, watching over the gates into the North Main woods. All the same buildings on Main Street. All the same churches. All the same potholes. Evergreens exhale their sharp, fresh scent, and potato fields roll outward to kiss the blue sky. Flowers grow. Flowers fade. The maple sap flows, the trees shed their leaves and put themselves to sleep for Aroostook County's long, hard winters. But there are differences. Some are subtle, like the heaviness that briefly settles on what should be joyful gatherings, such as graduations and retirement parties, as if anything worth celebrating is also something to be ashamed of, as if living is somehow selfish. Other changes are more prominent, though rarely talked about. Ollie Levasseur, that shit weasel, turned Bev's beloved Whispering Pines into little more than death's overpriced waiting room for the old folks in town. Annette Fraser, Bridget's mother, became an alcoholic recluse, only coming down off Rich Fucker Road to buy groceries or pick up the packages that, if rumors are to be believed, are from those wretched home shopping networks. And Bev's son, Nate Thoreau, 30 years old now, single father and widower. He's decided he'd rather work as a kiln operator at his father-in-law's mill than go back to the career he's meant for with the Dalton Police Department. The changes have touched Bev and Trudy as well.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?